Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and in the early hours of Saturday, the 15th of February, these are our main stories. The high cost of the coronavirus for healthcare workers in China. A week-long truce could soon come into force between US forces in Afghanistan and the Taliban. But will it lead to a US withdrawal? And a protest in India against humiliating rules for young women at a university campus. Also in this podcast, it's not all fun to live in a modernist building that's been declared a World Heritage Site.
Yo cuando llegué hasta casa, al principio la encontraba pues...
When I first got in this house, I found it difficult to place furniture. There isn't a single straight wall.
And how Valentine's Day was marked in some unusual ways. But first, they're on the front line of fighting the COVID-19 coronavirus outbreak. Now, Beijing has confirmed that some 1,700 healthcare workers have been infected so far. China's National Health Commission says the psychological pressure on doctors and nurses remains high, as does the risk of infection. This weekend, the World Health Organization is sending a team to China to find ways of keeping them healthy. It refers to them as the glue in the fight against the virus. So why have so many become ill? And why is this figure only now being released? A question for our Asia Pacific regional editor, Michael Bristow.
It's a good question, and I'm sure a question lots of people in China are asking. The WHO actually has just said that perhaps that figure is in line with other outbreaks, for example, SARS nearly 20 years ago, a similar kind of virus. And the reason they give for it is because, of course, doctors and nurses are in the front line of any outbreak, which happens when people get ill, they go to hospitals. Who do they see? Doctors and nurses. So, of course, they're likely to be a group which might catch it. Add on to this the fact that this is a new virus, so doctors and nurses weren't looking for these particular symptoms. They were unaware. They unknowingly exposed themselves, perhaps, to this virus. And it was only later on, when they got the proper clothing, the proper way to use them and proper training, that they were able to reduce the number of health workers who were infected. This is actually what Dr. Michael Ryan from the WHO had to say about this issue.
Our understanding is that the cases amongst health workers peaked in the third and fourth week of January, and there's been a rapid fall off in the number of cases that have occurred in health workers in the last 2 weeks. This may reflect increased levels of training, increased levels of protection, and also increased levels of awareness. Remember, this outbreak has expanded very quickly in an unsuspecting health system. So we also need to look at how many of those health workers were exposed unknowingly within a clinical environment, how many were wearing protective equipment, how many had training. There's a whole load of factors we need to look at.
So Dr. Ryan there is talking about how perhaps things are better now. The Chinese authorities managed to get a handle on the spread of infections amongst the healthcare professionals. But when the WHO team arrives in China on the ground, what kind of access are they going to get? How are they going to work, do you think, with the Chinese officials?
Well, it's worth pointing out that all along the WHO have praised China for being quite open about information, passing on that information to the WHO, who have then been able to pass it on to countries around the world. They now are getting this weekend a team of 24 experts, 12 from China, 12 international health experts, some from the United States. And what they're going to be doing is looking over the data. They're going to be travelling around to various places, rural places, urban places, and essentially looking at how this epidemic has progressed, looking to spot patterns so that they can in the future kind of limit its spread and deal with it more effectively. That's what they're going to be doing.
Michael Bristow, the largest single outbreak of the coronavirus outside China is not in a country, but on a cruise ship, the Diamond Princess, which is currently being held in quarantine in the Japanese port of Yokohama, has confirmed that 218 people on board have contracted COVID-19 so far. There's growing concern at the way Japan is managing that outbreak. Health experts say a ship is a completely inappropriate place to quarantine so many people with what appears to be a highly contagious virus on board. Rupert Wingfield-Hayes reports from Yokohama.
For the 3,700 people stuck on board the Diamond Princess, there was some good news today. No new infections have been found on the ship in the last 24 hours. The Japanese government is also finally letting some of the most frail passengers get off. This afternoon, 11 people, all over the age of 80, were driven away in a bus to continue their quarantine elsewhere. More elderly passengers may follow, but for everyone else, the waiting continues. In their cabin, Phil and Gay Corter from Florida are in good spirits. But they told me they are extremely frustrated that the Japanese government is taking so long to test everybody.
We absolutely should have been tested. The test results could have been back. The people who tested immediately and were clear should have been off the boat. That's what they did in Hong Kong.
We're the second worst cluster after Wuhan, China, in the world. Doesn't that call for at least testing us?
Public health experts agree. They say the cramped conditions on board the huge ship could be allowing the virus to continue spreading. But Tokyo is about to host the Summer Olympic Games, and Japan is determined the virus will not be allowed to get loose on shore. That may already be too late. Last night, Japan recorded its first death from the COVID-19 virus and 9 new infections, including a Tokyo taxi driver, all with no connection either to the Diamond Princess or to travellers from China.
Well, the coronavirus is obviously a hugely significant story, and we're going to be recording an extra edition of the Global News podcast soon to put your questions to a panel of experts. We'll have details on how to get involved a bit later on, so do keep listening. A senior US official has said a 7-day truce between the United States and the Taliban in Afghanistan will take effect very soon, and it could lead to the withdrawal of American troops. American and Taliban negotiators have been holding talks for over a year about steps towards an American pullout. They were on the verge of a deal last September when President Trump abruptly suspended talks following the death of a US soldier. The latest details emerged at the Munich Security Conference in Germany, which the US Secretary of State and Afghan Foreign Minister are attending. Our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, is there.
Well, I think these comments by a senior American official have caused a lot of interest because we haven't been hearing a lot about this, what is truly, when it happens, an historic deal between the U.S. government and the Afghan Taliban ever since President Trump suddenly cancelled it all last September. And the talks were very slow to resume again. But we've known for some days now that they are very close. And so we got more details, a confirmation that they are very close from a senior American official, a confirmation that there has been what seems to be an agreement that the Afghan Taliban will commit themselves to what's being called a reduction in violence, not the more politically sensitive term of a ceasefire, but a time of calm across Afghanistan. And if they keep their word, this will then lead to the signing of this deal, which would involve Taliban security guarantees in exchange for a phased and conditional U.S. troop withdrawal. That's the second part. And the third part, and really that is the most important, most difficult part, but really a crucial one for Afghans. That will be the talks among Afghans about the shape of peace, how to get there. And what Afghans want to find out, what are the Taliban like now? They ruled with such a heavy hand, such a harsh interpretation of Islam in the 1990s. They say they're different. Many Afghans ask, how different are they? So I think we believe that Afghanistan is a step closer to that process, but until we have an official announcement that the clock is ticking on that 7 days of a reduction in violence, then I think we have to wait a bit longer.
That was Lise Doucette in Munich. A police complaint has been filed against the head of a university in India, where a group of students were ordered to remove their underwear to prove that they weren't menstruating. Officials in Gujarat are investigating reports that 68 girls living in a college block were required to undress because of rules barring them from certain areas during their period. In many parts of India, there is still a taboo around the subject of menstruation, as our South Asia correspondent Rajini Vaidyanathan explains.
Students from the Sri Sahajanand Girls Institute say they were marched through the campus to the toilet block, where they were asked to strip. Some who've spoken to the BBC say college staff told them not to talk about what happened.
They took us off one by one and checked if we were menstruating. They didn't touch us, but they really had a go at us, so much that we took our clothes off to let them check.
Reports say the students were made to do so after a worker at the college dormitory made a complaint that the girls were breaking the rules. The institute, which is run by a Hindu trust, bans menstruating women from entering or eating in the hostel's kitchen areas. Darshana Dolaki is from the college.
The girls volunteered to get checked, so the staff did, but they didn't touch them. The girls were menstruating. They apologised. The students were at fault as they'd lied about it.
This case is a reminder that there's a huge stigma around menstruation in many parts of India. Women who are having their periods are often considered dirty, forced to stay away from places of worship and other common areas. The authorities have promised a full investigation into this latest incident, but it won't change a deep-rooted mindset, which still exists in some communities.
That was Rajini Vajanathan reporting. Now, you might expect the Himalayas to be a pristine paradise, but many of Nepal's busy climbing routes are far from it. Oxygen canisters, old clothing, tents, and human excrement litter large areas. But Nepal's plan to use soldiers to clear up around 35,000 kilos of waste from Everest and five other Himalayan peaks are being criticised by some of the region's leading mountaineers. They're calling on the government to pay Sherpas, who expertly scale the peaks on a regular basis, to do the job instead. I've been speaking to Surendra Phul from the BBC's Nepali service in Kathmandu.
The Sherpas are basically saying that the garbage is piling up at 8,000 metre elevations in these mountains are something that are beyond the reach of the Nepali army or the army personnel. They say it's something only they can take care of because they are the ones taking all the risk and climbing all these mountains and helping all these climbers from all over the world get to the top. So they know where these garbages are. And the army, what the army is doing is basically they are airlifting all the garbages collected from base camps of these mountains and bringing them safely back to nearby towns. So the Sherpa people are demanding, the Sherpa climbers are demanding that let them have a greater say and greater role in you know, clearing up these garbages from higher elevations and higher altitudes.
So how's this dispute going to be resolved in the end, do you think?
I think the Nepali army will eventually deploy more Sherpas this time around. Like the army spokesperson I spoke to, Bigyan Dev Pandey, he told me the other day that this time they will take lessons from last year when they had only a handful of Sherpas. This time around, I think what they're going to do, they're going to deploy higher and deploy more and more Sherpas. Who are, you know, going to the higher elevations.
So whoever ends up doing this job, it's one that desperately needs to be done, isn't it? And it's not just rubbish, is it?
The Sherpa climbers and expedition members and the mountaineering experts I spoke to were saying that they still have dead bodies dating back to several decades, you know, and also dead bodies of climbers from recent years that are, basically lying right on the trail leading to the summits or the tops of these mountains peaks. So they're saying that they are urgently in need of, removal. I mean, they need to be removed at any cost. But the problem, again, is that, you know, for example, if a climber weighs 80 kilo, his body is heavily iced now, and then that weighs thrice as much now. So it takes enormous amount of energy, time, and resources, and a lot of risk also for climbers, for Sherpas, to bring those bodies safely down.
That was Surendra Phul in Kathmandu. Now, with information about a special podcast, here's my colleague Jackie Leonard.
The coronavirus, also known by some as COVID-19, is a developing story which touches on many countries and many aspects of life. So we are planning an extra edition of the Global News podcast when we will put your questions to a panel of experts. If there is something that you want to know, be it about the health and prevention aspects, treatment, travel, business, tourism, or just how nations and international bodies are working to try and beat it, just ask. Record yourself, just on your phone, it doesn't need to be fancy. Tell us who you are, where you are, what you want to know, then attach it to an email and send it to globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. We aim to record it in the coming weeks. Thanks.
Now, when the South African president, Cyril Ramaphosa, delivered his State of the Nation address on Thursday, he was repeatedly interrupted by the far-left economic freedom fighters and their leader, Julius Malema. It wasn't so much the president's speech they objected to, but the presence in Parliament of F.W. de Klerk, the last president of the apartheid era. The EFF accused him of being an unrepentant racist and wanted him ejected. Our Southern Africa correspondent Nomsa Maseko asked Mr. de Klerk how he felt about the accusations.
It's a blatant lie to say I'm an unrepentant apologist of apartheid. I have made profound apologies for the pain that apartheid has caused. I've said on many occasions in South Africa and internationally, apartheid was wrong, was morally unjustified. So it's a lie. And I'm ashamed of what happened in Parliament last night, not for my sake, but for the sake of the image of our Parliament.
Do you have any regrets about saying that apartheid was not a crime against humanity?
It wasn't my original idea that it wasn't a crime against apartheid. When I said that recently in an interview, I was in line with the Security Council of that time. I was in line with Great Britain, with America, with Sweden, with Norway.
But what do you think about apartheid personally?
Apartheid was wrong. I have profusely apologized for it. I haven't only apologized. I and my team initiated the process which brought apartheid to an end.
President Cyril Ramaphosa recently said that South Africans shouldn't thank you for releasing the likes of Nelson Mandela from prison. What do you think about that?
I don't want the country to thank me, but I do want history to be correctly recorded. The ANC wants to rewrite history as if what happened in 1990 and from 1990 to 96 was just the result of their struggle. Yes, of course it played a role, their struggle. Yes, I give credit that they played a crucial role in that whole process. But we did as well.
You were president of a racist regime. Are you yourself racist?
I was not president of a racist regime. I'm often referred to as the last apartheid president. I was the first white president who really abolished apartheid. My predecessor started by repealing 100 apartheid laws already. So we were bent on reform.
Do you have any regrets about what you've just mentioned now? Or would you have done anything differently?
All the major decisions I took, with the advantage of hindsight, I would take again today. Yes, no regrets.
How would you like to be remembered?
It's not for me to write my own epitaph, but I would like to be remembered as somebody who made a positive, constructive difference at a crucial time in our history, and that I played a role in averting a catastrophe in South Africa.
F.W. de Klerk speaking to Nomsa Maseko. La Pedrera is one of the Spanish architect Antoni Gaudi's best-known buildings in Barcelona, a sweeping arc of grey stone, all curves. It's a tourist landmark attracting around 1 million visitors a year, around the clock. It was commissioned as a block of rented apartments over a century ago. The surprising thing, it's still a home, as our reporter Sergi Forcada has been finding out.
From outside, in one of the major avenues in Barcelona, La Pedrera looks like many other tourist attractions, with lines of visitors queuing to get in and taking pictures of the uneven stone facade designed by Antoni Gaudí. Most tourists, though, are unaware they are about to enter a landmark three women can call home. One of the three remaining tenants is writer Ana Viladomiu. She moved to La Pedrera in 1987, when she married her husband, who was already living there. She now lives on her own in a whitewashed flat over 300 square meters big. But with people queuing outside the building, she often finds herself elbowing her way home.
It's common for me to get home and find a line of people, security personnel and hostesses. It's normal for me, but I understand this is not common. I feel like home. Well, it is my home.
Okay. Hi. Can I scan your bag, please?
Can I leave it here or...?
Yes, in the scanner, please.
It's a home full of security cameras and smoke detectors. And while Anna doesn't get her belongings checked, visitors do.
Me siento segura y me siento controlada.
I feel very safe, but also controlled. If I cook a steak and there's a bit more smoke than usual, security calls me. Is anything going on? Anything burning? Well, it's a lot of security, which I like. It has its side effect, and it's clear they control my life as well. Unintentionally, but they know who I get in the house with, if I get in with bags, if I'm in a bad mood, and sometimes they say, oh, you were in late yesterday? It's the negative side. You don't have any privacy.
On top of feeling the pressure of tourism, living inside a masterpiece has other side effects. This is a protected building, which means there are a few things that can't be changed. The brown, elaborate, triangular pattern parquet floor in the living room is still the original, now consumed by woodworms. Anna's flat, like the whole construction, is a continuing curve, which gives a sense of dynamism, but also raises practical issues.
When I first got in this house, I found it difficult to place furniture. There isn't a single straight wall. I would place a rug and it wouldn't look right. The bookshelves wouldn't hold on well because everything's curved. Even the cutters were a problem.
It's a busy building. Its seven floors are not only dedicated to tourism, but also include company offices and spaces to host exhibitions or conferences. With only three tenants left, what's the future of this building?
This is the big question for La Pedrera. What will happen with La Pedrera once the three of us are no longer here? It would be nice to preserve it as a block for neighbors, as it was built for that purpose. There are kitchens, bathrooms. It was not designed for offices. But who would rent these apartments? I pay an old rent. If they had to rent them out now, they would be very expensive.
In the meantime, Anna and the other tenants in La Pedrera have no intention of moving out of Gaudí's most famous home.
Oh, Sergi Forcada. The English Premier League champions, Manchester City, say that they're disappointed but not surprised that they've been banned from European football for the next two seasons. The club has also been fined more than $30 million, but it says it's going to appeal. The sports governing body in Europe, UEFA, says the club committed serious breaches of financial fair play regulations designed to stop rich teams gaining an unfair advantage. The former Man City player, Michael Brown, believes the club is going to take the ban in its stride.
I think the club has been aware that there's been a problem there. They've issued a very, very strong statement that they're going to try and correct this decision, and I'm sure they will do. Will the recruitment be a little bit harder? Yes, it will. But if any club, any owners can take this on, then I think it's Manchester City.
With more details, here's Joe Wilson.
We know that this process has been going on for some time, and UEFA have been talking about this thing called financial fair play for almost a decade, but this is real teeth. This is a real impact to that idea. The principle, I think, is that they don't want football just to become the wealthiest clubs always winning. In other words, the road to your success in European football not simply being, well, get the wealthiest owner you can find. So Manchester City are owned by, effectively, the Abu Dhabi ruling family. They also get sponsorship from Etihad Airlines. Now, sponsorship is a legitimate source of income for any football club. Etihad Airlines, also owned by the Abu Dhabi ruling family. So what, in simple terms, UEFA has decided is that it's one and the same thing. Right. That it's really the same pot of money, if you can imagine it, but really being portioned out in a different way. And in effect, Manchester City have broken those financial fair play rules. And this punishment of 2 years not able to play in the Champions League, bear in mind this is a club that's put its whole status on that idea of winning the European Champions League. And that, as we perceive it now, has been taken away from them.
It certainly has. That was Joe Wilson. And finally, love is in the air, everywhere I look around. Yeah, Friday was, of course, St. Valentine's Day, and we thought what better way to end the podcast than with a roundup of romantic or maybe not so romantic news from around the world. Our reporter Charlotte Gallagher takes us first to Russia.
Yes, because everyone wants a different proposal now. So they get all the likes on Instagram. You can't just have flowers, candles, a hot air balloon even. You need something really different. So a Russian soldier decided he'd get his mates in the tank regiment to manoeuvre their tanks into the shape of a heart. Then he would walk his bride-to-be into the middle of where these tanks were pointing their guns at them. She was kind of covering her eyes at the time. And then she took off her blindfold, and he was down on one knee with a bunch of flowers, asking her to marry him as the guns were pointing at them.
Almost an offer you can't refuse.
Well, yeah, exactly. What would have happened if she'd have said no? I'm sure she did look incredibly happy. She said, "Dar," straight away. They looked very much in love. And then he kind of picked her up in Officer and a Gentleman style and, you know, slung her around and walked off into the sunset. Very, very happy together.
So he pulled out all the stops. Meanwhile, if you want to propose to somebody in the UK, you can do it with a very, very cheap ring.
What price can you put on love? What price?
Ooh,
a pound.
A pound.
In the UK, you can put the price of a pound on love. So Poundland, which, as you might have guessed, is a shop where everything costs a pound, they've been selling rings for that price called bling rings, and they've sold 40,000 of these rings in the run-up to Valentine's Day. And the shop is saying, look, we're not saying that these are the permanent rings. They're kind of just a sort of temporary one until you get the real thing. Okay. What would your wife have said when if you proposed with a pound ring then?
She probably would have sent me to spend Valentine's Day in Texas, because that's a more macabre way of doing it, isn't it?
Yes. So we've all been there. We've all been heartbroken. Maybe you haven't been, Nick, but have you ever been heartbroken?
Yeah, frequently.
Have you ever been scorned?
Yes.
Have you been really angry?
Yes.
Okay, horrid. So what better way to do it than go to San Antonio Zoo in Texas? You can name a cockroach after your ex, and then it'll be fed to an animal, or even a rat. You can name a rat after your ex, and then you can watch it on a live stream while it's being munched by an animal.
Lovely. And they're not bitter at all, are they?
No, I mean, I'm not bitter. No, I'm not going to do it.
Charlotte Gallagher reporting. And that's all from us for now, but there's going to be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this edition, the topics covered in it, or indeed the coronavirus, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.